Good morning. It's great to be here in a different capacity from usual. And nice to see all of you. The opening words are a story called The Rabbi's Gift. There was once a thriving abbey, which then fell upon hard times. The brothers had been leaving. Novices were not joining. There was no longer quite enough food, and morale had really deteriorated. The abbot was deeply worried, and so he went off into the woods to consult the rabbi, who was locally known as a very wise man. He often retreated to his woodland hut to meditate and reflect. The rabbi welcomed him warmly and invited him to have a meal with him. Over the meal and some tea, they talked at length about their abbey and their synagogue. The abbot confided his very deep concern over the state of the abbey. The rabbi listened very respectfully and finally said, "My dear friend, I don't know what to tell you. I have no suggestions, no advice. I'm really sorry. I wish I could be wiser, but that's it." "Well," the abbot said, "never mind. I've enjoyed the visit, and I'll just go back and make the best of things." As he got up to leave, the rabbi said, Oh, there is just one thing I should tell you. One among you is the Messiah." Imagine carrying that back. Well, the abbot went back to the abbey, and all of the monks gathered around him and asked, "Well, what did the rabbi say?" The abbot shook his head and said, "He couldn't make any suggestions or give us any advice, but he said just one thing, and it was pretty odd. He said that one among us is the Messiah." Well, the monks, of course, were astonished, and they all went off to think this over. One of them? Well, rabbis know about messiahs, so, you know, they had to take this seriously. So each one began to think of various candidates for messiahship. Well, the abbot was the obvious choice, right? But he did have his faults. What about Brother John? He was always so willing to serve, but he was pretty foolish sometimes. The Messiah couldn't be foolish. Brilliant Brother Thomas? Well, he was kind of short-tempered, and surely the Messiah would not be short-tempered. Me? God knows it couldn't be me. Could it? And so on. And none of them had any idea who among them could possibly be the Messiah. But gradually, a change came over the abbey. The brothers began smiling at each other more often and listening more carefully to each other, treating each other with more respect. I mean, after all, any one of them could be the Messiah, and, you know, you don't want to mess up with the Messiah, really. Then something else began to happen. People who visited the abbey noticed a difference in the atmosphere. More of them began showing up at services. Over time, new brothers joined the community. I'd like to think, adding my own spin to the story, that women started joining too. A new way developed of relating to each other, with a greater sense of wholeness about the place. Within a few years, the abbey was a thriving place with plenty of food and supplies, but most of all, a spirit of mutual respect and goodwill among the sisters and brothers. It had become a real community. Last Sunday, Eric's last Sunday with us, I was struck by his blockbuster farewell sermon and Adam Slate's reflections about God language, but also by some other words. The sense of loss expressed by Alex, our assistant minister, and Karen Ransom, as well as their gratitude for the gifts Eric leaves with us. And Alex's faith in this congregation, I hope you heard that. We know that we are standing at the edge of a great change. Most of us have lived through great changes in our own lives. We know they're scary, even the welcome ones like college, new job, marriage, a baby, retirement. The hard ones, the death of someone we love, losing a job, divorce, can overwhelm us. I've experienced all these changes, and I've learned three things about them. They can plunge us into the unfamiliar. We don't know how to navigate our new reality. I hear that expressed here, now. We can even wonder who we are or will become. Second, I have found that we do somehow go or muddle forward and gradually find our footing in that new reality. And third, we ourselves are never the same again. The changes in our lives, whether for better or worse, whether chosen or thrust upon us, change us for better or for worse. When Karen likened the church to a garden last Sunday, I got swept into her metaphor because, like her, I am a devoted gardener. You could say addicted. I live with things emerging from soil, struggling into light, thirsting for water, consuming compost, thriving and blooming, or withering and dying. Karen said that Eric has planted seeds here that will still grow and flourish. It occurs to me that it's not alone what Eric planted here. He always called us a community of ministers. It's what we've planted with him and will continue to plant. And it's also how we cultivate what we plant. What do we choose to water? What do we choose to weed away? Back when I grew vegetables, before I finally surrendered to the groundhog family who shared our yard, I ordered my vegetable seeds from a company called Seeds of Change. Maybe some of you have heard of it. It sold exclusively organic heirloom seeds in hope of contributing to a change in gardening methods to healthier and more environmentally responsible ones. It's such a hopeful name, Seeds of Change. But gardening, watching seeds sprout and what they sprout grow and what grows change profoundly, I understand this process as much deeper and more complex than change. Change is sort of like a swap. We change our clothes. We change our clocks at daylight savings time. In summer, I change my morning routine, walk early when it's cooler, attend to household tasks later. These are simple exchanges of one thing or one practice for another. What happens to a seed when it begins to produce a plant is different. Organic, gradual, profound. The name of this sermon was going to be Seeds of Change, but I changed it. Seeds of Transformation. Because that's what we undergo if we pay attention and if we are intentional when we live through a time of great change, which is what I encourage us to do in our time together ahead. I don't know if you remember a toy from the 80s. My son had a few, and they might still exist. Transformers? Yeah, okay, you know. Well, it would be an everyday object, you know, like a cup. Well, not a cup, not that simple. A car, a radio, something with parts. And when you twisted this part and that part in very prescribed ways, it would become a very scary looking robot. You twist all those parts back the way they were, and presto changeo, you've got your car or your radio. Now, I never got how this thing qualified as a transformer. The process was mechanical, linear, and always produced exactly the same result. The same car, the same robot, back to the same car. It changed, sure. But what happened wasn't at all what I have experienced as transformation. It's not what happens in a seed or an embryo or a growing human soul. It's not what happens in and to us when we encounter a wilderness to cross, a demand upon our best selves to make a new thing out of the unknown. Think of the times that you have chosen a new path and found yourself perhaps exhilarated, but scared about where it might lead. Or when you have fallen face first into unexpected and unwanted loss and forgotten for weeks or months, years, which way was up. 18 years ago, I made the same choice that Eric has just made. After 8 years in my third parish ministry, an apparently successful solo ministry with a congregation I loved, I resigned. Also in May, and to the congregation, completely unexpectedly. But I had been journeying the previous 3 years in discouragement and finally despair. The leadership had been moving away from the path they'd asked me to help them take when they had called me, in which we had made real and exciting progress. I didn't know that this often happens at the time. I didn't want to go backward, and I saw that they weren't going to go any farther forward at that time. I was exhausted and dispirited. I had not been in search for a new ministry, so had no job to go to. They barely had time to find an interim minister. Neither the congregation nor I could know what lay ahead. They were in shock, and I was in grief. I can't vouch for exactly how they moved through that time because, of course, I had to step away. But they have now been 17 years with a successful minister and just celebrated the reopening of their church after extensive remodeling, so they have thrived. Well, at first, I knew, of course what I would do. Find a ministry with a congregation with a firmer sense of its identity. But when a colleague invited me to develop his large congregation's pastoral care program, just part-time, I'm quoting him now, for a year or two while you figure out your future, you know, I felt that undeniable yes, which you know you cannot say no to. And over the next couple of years, an unexpected vista opened up. In addition to loving that job, in which I stayed for 4 years, I enrolled in the Shalem Institute for Spiritual Formation Spiritual Direction Program, the same one Eric completed just about that time. And as things progressed, and as I observed what was going on in me and where I felt led and called, I eventually left parish ministry for what I came to call my freelance community ministry of spiritual direction, retreats, workshops, and pastoral care trainings for congregations. It didn't look anything like what I had envisioned when I left a church a few years earlier. Many colleagues were jealous of me. It's been the favorite part of my 30 plus years of ministry. And now in retirement, I continue to practice and love spiritual direction. And I hope to do it until I can't think straight anymore. I'm grateful now that I was too tired and dispirited to do what everyone counseled me to do, jump back in the saddle. Staying with the questions my experience raised, I reflected, sought counsel, and noticed where I felt called. What was trying to grow, I now know, had a chance to grow. Do you know the story of Jacob in Genesis? I'm sure some of you do. He cheated his older brother Esau of his birthright and of their father's blessing meant for the eldest son, which was extremely important to those folks. He fled to a faraway country where he fell in love with Rachel, worked 7 years for her father to earn the right to marry her, but was tricked into marrying her less attractive sister Leah, then worked another 7 years to earn Rachel. And meanwhile, he bred his father-in-law's sheep in a clever way to wind up owning most of the offspring. Finally, wealthy, with two wives, two concubines, and a batch of children, he returned to his home country, where, he heard that Esau was coming to greet him. Esau, who had every reason to hate him, who might want to kill him. He spent the night alone, away from his caravan, very anxious, as we can imagine, mulling over the possibilities, the dangers. Maybe he even prayed. There came to him in the night a man, the story goes, who wrestled with him all night until daybreak. Jacob does not give in. He stays in the struggle. This is a struggle with what this man represents, the need to confront what in himself has brought him to this pass. We are dealing here with an obvious psychological metaphor, a spiritual metaphor. At daybreak, the man angel, who can't beat Jacob, touches his hip socket, giving Jacob a limp for the rest of his life. And then he tells Jacob, "It's getting light, let me go." But Jacob, staying in the trouble, in the struggle, says, "No, not until you give me your blessing." The angel instead asks Jacob's name. Jacob, usurper. And he gives him a new one, Israel. He who has struggled with God and men and prevailed, progenitor of a people. Only then does he bless him. The next day, he and Esau meet with welcome from Esau and gifts on both sides. Jacob has become a man who will live in peace with his brother and raise 12 sons to father the 12 tribes of Israel. He will do it imperfectly, of course, because everybody in Genesis does life imperfectly. Being transformed doesn't mean you achieve perfection. It means that who you are has been enlarged and deepened, your perspective made clearer, your embrace wider, your heart more open, your mind closer to your heart. And so it is with the struggles in which we stay the course. We are touched so that we're never the same, but so also we are renamed. I think this is the big difference between simple change and transformation. Those transformers of my sons did not experience any internal change. They just got superficially changed, like clothing or clocks. Seeds. We don't know what they experience, so to speak. But there is mysterious wonder in the seed emerging as sprout, reaching into light and air, in a creeping caterpillar emerging as a winged flyer, a human being emerging from crisis as a more human, more whole being, a community growing through struggle, staying in its struggle, wrestling with its angels, confronting itself in all its aspects to emerge stronger, healed, healing, with an unimagined blessing. What do we need to stay in our struggle? I'll go back to something I said at the start of this sermon, intention and attention. The intention to stay in it. Open, non-judgmental attention to each other and to what is going on in our own hearts. And I remember what my spiritual director said to me when I was muddled in a darkness. We don't need to see the path ahead. We only need just enough light to see the next step forward. Let's take a moment of silence.